Army, Navy, and Air Force facilities. The Atomic Energy Commission retained custody of only those kept at its own storage sites. And in December 1959, the military had finally won the kind of control that it had sought since the end of the Second World War. Eisenhower agreed to let high-ranking commanders decide whether to use nuclear weapons during an emergency when the president couldn't be reached. He had wrestled with the decision, well aware that such advance authorization could allow someone to do something foolish down the chain of command and start an all-out nuclear war. But the alternative would be to let American and NATO forces be overrun and destroyed if communications with Washington were disrupted. At first, Eisenhower told the Joint Chiefs that he was very fearful of having written papers on this matter. Later, he agreed to sign a pre-delegation order, insisting that its existence never be revealed. It is in the U.S. interest to maintain the atmosphere that all authority to use nuclear weapons stays with the U.S. president without delegation, he stressed. Eisenhower's order was kept secret from Congress, the American people, and NATO allies. It made sense as a military tactic, but it also introduced an element of uncertainty to the decision-making process. The PSYOP was centralized, inflexible, and mechanistic. The pre-delegation order was exactly the opposite. It would rely on individual judgments made in the heat of battle, thousands of miles from the White House. Under certain circumstances, a U.S. commander under attack with conventional weapons would be allowed to respond with nuclear weapons. Eisenhower knew all too well that delegating presidential authority could mean losing control of whether, how, and why a nuclear war would be fought. He understood the contradictions at the heart of America's command and control system, but couldn't find a way to resolve them during his last few weeks in office. Breaking in. Colonel John T. Moser and his wife had just finished dinner, and they were getting ready to leave the house for a concert when the phone rang. "There's a problem at Launch Complex 3747," the controller said. "It could be a fire." Moser told his wife to go without him, put on his uniform, got in his car, and headed to the command post. They lived on the base, and the drive didn't take long. On the way, Moser radioed ahead, telling the controller to assemble the missile potential hazard team. It was 6:40 in the evening, about 10 minutes after a mysterious white cloud had appeared in the silo. The command post of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing resembled an executive boardroom, with a long conference table in the middle, communications equipment, and a chalkboard. It could accommodate 25 or 30 people. Moser was the wing commander, and when he arrived at the post, it was still largely empty, and the status of the missile unclear. The sprays were on, dumping water into the silo. Stage 1 fuel pressure was falling, while the oxidizer pressure was rising. Flashing red lights in the control center at 4-7 warned there was a fuel leak, an oxidizer leak, a fire in the silo. Three things that couldn't be happening at once. Adding to the confusion, Captain Mazzaro and Lieutenant Childers, the crew commander and deputy commander at the site, had both called the command post using separate lines, one mentioning a fuel leak, the other a fire. Now Mazzaro was on the speakerphone, reporting the missile's tank pressures. His crew was going through checklists, trying to make sense of it all. Moser was a great believer in checklists. After graduating from Franklin and Marshall College in 1955, he'd joined the Strategic Air Command. 2 years later, he became the navigator of a KC-97 Stratotanker, an aircraft that refueled B-47 bombers mid-air. The Stratotanker was a propeller plane, and the B-47 a jet, prone to stalling at low speeds. The two had to rendezvous at a precise location, with the bomber flying behind and slightly below the tanker. At an altitude of 18,000 feet, they would connect via a hollow steel boom and fly in unison for 20 minutes, entering a shallow dive so that the tanker could keep up with the bomber. Aerial refueling was a delicate, often dangerous procedure. The crew of the Stratotanker had to coordinate every step carefully, not just with the crew of the B-47, but also with one another. Spontaneous or improvised maneuvers would not be appreciated. Moser later flew as a navigator on KC-135 tankers that refueled B-52s during airborne alerts. The success of these missions depended on checklists. Every move had to be standardized and predictable, as two large jets flew about 40 feet apart, linked by a boom, one plane carrying thermonuclear weapons, the other unloading 1,000 gallons of jet fuel a minute, day or night, through air turbulence and rough weather. Colonel Moser asked Mazzaro if the PTS team had done anything in the silo that could have caused the problem. Mazzaro got off the line and returned with an explanation. Airman Powell had dropped a socket into the silo, and the socket had pierced a hole in the Stage 1 fuel tank. Mazzaro put the airman on the phone and made him describe what had happened, an unusual decision that violated the chain of command. Hearing the details silenced everyone in the room. Moser realized this was a serious accident that called for an urgent response. He activated the Missile Potential Hazard Net, a conference call that would connect him with SAC headquarters in Omaha, the Ogden Air Logistics Center in Utah, and the headquarters of the 8th Air Force in Louisiana. But the communications equipment wasn't working properly, and for the next 40 minutes the controller in Little Rock tried to set up the call. Members of the hazard team were now filling the command post, officers and enlisted men who'd spent years working with the Titan II and its propellants. The missile wing's chief of safety sat at the conference table, along with the head of its technical engineering branch, a bio-environmental engineer, an electrical engineer, and the K crew. The K stood for on-call, and the four-man crew, a commander, a deputy commander, a missile facilities technician, and a missile systems analyst, served as backup to the launch crew at 4-7. The K crew could help interpret the data coming from the site, pore through the Dash 1 and other operating manuals, offer a second opinion. The skills of everyone in the room focused on the question of how to save the missile. SAC didn't have a checklist for the problem they now faced, and so they would have to write one. Moser needed all the technical assistance he could get. He was new to the job, having been in Little Rock for about 3 months. During that brief time, he'd come to be regarded as